Hey y'all, welcome back to the DIY Entrepreneurs Reaction Show. I'm so glad you decided to tune in with me today. Go ahead and hit that like button and become a subscriber to the channel if you're not already a subscriber. I would really appreciate that. During my day job, I'm a technology person, and so I work behind the scenes in this company and I do things technology wise. I don't really want to get into it, but I attended a Salesforce conference last week. They streamed it live. I didn't attend it like in person. They had people attended it in person, but I streamed it. And so during the Salesforce Dreamforce conference, they had a segment where they had ecopreneurs come up and give a pitch for their business in order to win $200,000. And so when it came on, I noticed it when it was coming on. Of course, I was working, but I noticed it when it came on and I wanted to make sure I recorded it and put it on the channel for you guys to watch it as well. And so again, this was some entrepreneurs that attended the Dreamforce conference, which is ran by Salesforce. And if you don't know Salesforce company, it is a company, a cloud-based software that you can use for customer relationship management. And a lot of salespeople use it. A lot of companies use it. And they're really starting to dominate the space in that cloud-based CRM industry. And so if you don't know of Salesforce, you have to check it out. And you like technology, you have to check it out. I'll be sitting for my exam in a couple of months. And so I'm looking forward to being certified in Salesforce as a Salesforce admin. But enough about me. Let's check out these ecopreneurs. And these are people who have businesses that may affect like climate change and does things for the whole, you know, the ecosystem of the world. And that's where their businesses really lie in. And so there were three pitches. Three people came up and did their pitch, and they were in a running for winning $200,000 for their business idea. And so, and I believe all of them were already in business, but we'll see. I was kind of in and out because it happened during the daytime while I was working, and I had it on one of my other screens. And so I thought that I would capture it and again put it to the channel. So I'm coming in right when she introduces the first judge. I believe there was like four judges, I believe, but we'll see. You'll see the introduction of the judges, and then you'll see the ecopreneurs giving their pitch, and then who they pick to win. And so share your comments below, let me know what you think. But I thought that this would be a great addition to the channel, so let me know if you like it. All right, let's check it out.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Magic. And let's keep that energy up for all of our judges. All right, next up is a partner at Lower Carbon Capital, where she invests in unreasonably ambitious teams building climate tech and it will move the needle for the planet and its people. Let's welcome Mia Jawara. Mia, thank you, thank you. I love it. Keep the energy going, because we are going to bring up our next judge, the former CFO of the Joe Biden presidential campaign, now focusing her efforts on companies, let's hear it, and causes combating climate change, as the co-head of innovation and expansion at Galvanized Climate Solutions, Saluni Multani. Thank you, thank you. All right, and final judge is responsible for the fastest growing business at Deloitte. I was here from the Deloitte crew at least. Come on. Driving the go-to-market and commercial strategy for Deloitte Digital in the U.S., her personal passion follows her own journey. She's championing talent development, especially women in technology, supporting the professional growth of her team, and fostering outreach in the communities we serve. We've already given a warm welcome to the Deloitte Chief Digital Commercial Officer for the U.S., Dunya Sonali. All right, this is exciting. Okay, so now we want to explain the rules a little bit. There's going to be 30 points that you can award to each one of these ecopreneurs, and they fall into three categories. Everyone paying attention here. 10 points for creativity, up to 10 points for scalability, up to 10 points for sustainability impact. So that's a total of 30 you can give to each person. Now, Saluni, I know you've been a CFO. If there's any questions, maybe you can handle that within the team, because that was a lot of math we just shared there. And we also have a lot of expertise on this panel, and it's amazing, but there's also some power to the people we want to give. And that's why this year also, you all are going to have a chance to participate as well. After everybody presents from the ecopreneurs, we will put up a QR code on the screen, and that's when the room will be able to hold up their phones and be able to participate by voting. And the ecopreneur that gets the most votes will get an additional 10 points. And that could be really make or break and make a big impact on this contest. So we're very excited about that. So the judges will vote, the audience will vote, and we're going to end up with one big winner. So very exciting. All right. Are you ready to bring up the ecopreneurs, judges?
Ready.
You're ready. Okay. This is exciting. Our first ecopreneur is the CEO and founder of Urchinomics. He is here today from Norway. Let's welcome Brian Tsuyoshi Takeda to the stage.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Brian Tsuyoshi Takeda, and I would like to take this unique opportunity to talk to you all about kelp forests. Kelp forests are one of the most important ecosystems that we have on the planet. They are the foundation of our entire marine ecosystems. However, due to an unfortunate combination of overfishing of predatory species, climate change, and pollution, we have allowed the humble sea urchin to explode in population, overgrazing entire kelp forests and turning them into lifeless, desert-like barrens. In California, over 95% of the kelp forests of Northern California are already gone because of these overgrazing urchins. And Southern California has been suffering for over 2 decades. The problem with this, though, is that when sea urchins take over kelp forests and eat it up, they then starve and become empty, being commercially valueless for fishers to catch, and predatory species don't eat them either. So once an urchin barren establishes itself, it'll stay there for decades or centuries if we do not intervene. So what we do at Urchinomics is we specifically target those ecologically destructive urchins, and we rehome them into our proprietary land-based aquaculture systems. We then feed them a naturally derived formulated feed, and we convert them from an ecological pest to one of the world's most premium seafoods, or uni, in a matter of 6 to 12 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And as a result of removing these urchins from the ocean floor, we contribute to the restoration of kelp forests. And kelp forests can bounce back as fast as 3 months, like in California, or longer, like in 6 months in the Nordics when the sun disappears for a half a year. Why are we so occupied about kelp forests? It all comes down to the ecosystem services value. The ecosystem services value is just a scientific way of saying, what does this ecosystem mean to us in dollars and cents? And according to the latest science, kelp forests provide ecosystem services that are almost 30 times that of a tropical forest and 50 times that of a boreal forest. That is how critically important these ecosystems are. However, anywhere between 40 to 60% of kelp forests around the world are either declining or already have disappeared. Now, our business model is relatively straightforward. We remove the urchins, we ranch the urchins, we then sell the urchins in the form of uni, and we take a percentage of our revenues and put it back into the restoration effort. So, the active removal of the urchins from the ocean floor and the funding of the monitoring of the science directly contributes to the restoration of kelp forests. Now, in terms of traction, our technology platform has been validated on virtually all major urchin species in the Northern Hemisphere. We are now doing trials in the Southern Hemisphere to validate that we can, in fact, be a global solution to a global problem. So far, so good. In terms of our commercial operations, we have a full operating ranch in Japan, where we are selling our premium restorative sea urchins at the top restaurants and top retailers in the country. In California, after 3 years of looking for the right site and developing our R&D, we're finally at that point where we believe we can bring our urchins to market in California this year. and we will be launching it under the Sumire brand. So our commercial operations is focused in Japan, but we have pilots in California, Eastern Canada, Norway, and now developing in Australia and New Zealand. But this global initiative has gained some inertia. Urchinomics is one of three commercial ventures that are publicly endorsed by the United Nations Ocean Decade. We are also endorsed by Uplink at the World Economic Forum. And we also have a collaboration with the FAO in terms of food security. So I would like to close my presentation today with a request, an ask, not just to all of our friends watching around the world, but specifically to our friends in California. Californians, you are the guardians of one of the most important ecosystems that we have on this planet. So if there's one message that I'd like for you to take back, is talk to your friends, tell them about kelp forests, and tell them that through supporting ventures like us, by eating our uni, you can contribute to the restoration effort. But also don't forget the governmental agencies, the nonprofits, the scientists, the researchers that are all working together to tackle this problem, to preserve and restore our precious kelp forests. Thank you.
I think that was a very good presentation. I don't know anything about uni. I don't know anything about the kelp forest, but the way he explained it and the points that he made for his pitch, I think anybody would really be able to understand what he's talking about. And, you know, the only one thing that I saw or understood, there was one thing that I understood, though. They're not in the United States yet. After 3 years of doing some development and research, they're looking to start in California. And so they've done some things globally in other, you know, places, but not in United States yet. So I wonder if any of the judges will speak to that. And I wonder if that's what the whole 200 grand is going to go for. The winner of the competition is going to get 200 grand toward their initiative. And so let's see what questions the judges have for Brian.
Congratulations. Nice, Brian. Wonderful. And I love this. You're such an appreciative audience. I didn't even have to ask you to give it up for Brian. So now we're going to start the clock running again. We've got 10 minutes for some Q&A. I'll be here for moral support, Brian.
Brian, thank you so much for that presentation. The oceans are such a huge part of large-scale ecosystem restoration, and I think they're under-innovated, and it's underutilized as a resource, and so thank you for focusing on it. It's really inspiring. My question for you is, why now? What about today and the moment that we are in makes Urchinomics possible in a way that it hasn't been before?
Why now? I think the fundamental difference today is that we have a fundamental difference in appreciation of everything that we do. All decisions that we make are now being thought about through the lens of the environment and society, which may not have been true 5 or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But because of that, I find that the consumers are making different choices with their lifestyles. And so we would like to bring to the market a restorative product where the more you consume this product, the better the environment becomes. I think that's how we're going to get ourselves out of this ecological challenge that we face. We've dug such a deep hole for ourselves that just being sustainable is not good enough anymore. We need to be restorative, and we would like to be the example for that from the oceans.
Brian, can you talk a little bit about your marketing strategy to increase demand for sea urchins, maybe the other modes of consumption for sea urchins also beyond sushi restaurants and the top restaurants that you're working with today?
Right. So sea urchin roe consumption is actually disproportionately high in the east, but supply is severely limited. So for the short and foreseeable future, we'll have no real problems off-taking our products, at least in the eastern markets. When it comes to the west, I fully agree that there's another level of education that we need to do. Our plan is to start off at the premium restaurants, start at the omakases, the Michelin star restaurants, establish the brand, get the premium chefs talking about the product, and over time bring a lower cost product into the mainstream market so that everyone can be enjoying restorative seafood. But But yes, we're going to start off at the top when we have limited supply, but as our supply increases and our cost structure comes down, then we can mainstream it. But it's the only way we're going to have the impact that we want. Supplying just a number of Michelin star restaurants is not going to have the impact that we're looking for.
Thank you. Are you able to connect the activities you do in the ocean to remove these urchins with the ecosystem benefit market? So, you know, what is the impact of a given sea urchin removal on restoration of the kelp forest? What does that do in terms of carbon sequestration or biodiversity?
Yes, you're spot on. Thank you for teeing that up for me. So one of the beauties of kelp restoration is that there is an ecosystem restoration function. For example, governments like Japan has published a methodology to actually quantify and monetize the ecosystem restoration that happens. So Urchinomics will likely be the first in the world to get blue carbon credits for the kelp restoration that we do in Japan. I'm sure biodiversity credits will come at some point in time, but we're not really betting on that. We can make our numbers work just with the seafood product itself. The blue carbon and blue biodiversity benefits are just a bonus.
And do you have an ability to measure durability of the change? You referenced that a bit in your presentation, but just when you remove an urchin or urchins from a given area, the durability of the change in the carbon sequestered?
Yes. So the great thing about restoring standing stock kelp is that it's not like we're talking about the kelp that gets deposited 400 meters in the deep. That's very difficult to monitor. Restoring kelp forests that are within 10 to 20 meters is very easy to monitor with satellites or drones or just sticking your head in the water for that matter. So in that sense, it's very easy to monitor the status of the kelp forest. Of course, if we take away the predators that come back to that restored kelp forest, we will be creating that cycle, and we won't get beyond that. So our hope is that we can work with the fishers. Rather than the fishers continually extracting that of one particular species, they can perhaps do that too, but also harvest empty urchins for us, supply or supplement their income, while essentially diversifying their income stream and being restorative.
So Brian, when I played basketball, my competitors were Larry Bird and Michael Jordan. Who are your competitors?
Thankfully, I do not have Larry Jordan's in my universe. We have been very fortunate because we inherited 25 years of Norwegian state research that allowed us to get the technology to add value to empty sea urchins, and that has become essentially a very big barrier to entry for competitors. But at the same time, we don't want such barriers to prevent good work from happening. So Urchinomics has a program called Urchinomics Impact, where we essentially license our entire technology suite to nonprofits or governments that want to do restoration for the sake of the planet, on the condition that any profits that generated from that goes back into the restoration effort. So that's kind of our way of saying, look, the high profit markets, high profit opportunities, we will invest our private capital. But for the markets that don't quite make economic sense for us, we can still allow our technology to do good, it's just that it'll be in a different structure.
Brian, talk about how you can be cost effective, because you're going from the water, from the sea, bringing it in, selling it to the restaurants, right?
Yes.
And passing on, what type of cost does it cost those who want to eat?
So fortunately, sea urchin ranching, where we're not growing the animal out, but really just growing the precious caviar or gonads or the uni, that only takes 6 to 12 weeks. Aquaculture typically for salmon farming, for example, takes 3 years. So we have a fundamentally different business model. We can bring products in and out very quickly, so our operating costs are relatively low compared to traditional aquaculture. We're probably the only venture that you can think of in the aquaculture space that has a gross margin that is greater than 50%. That is almost unheard of in the industry.
Can you talk a little bit more about the technology itself? In particular, what do you see as being the biggest barriers to scalability, and how are you planning to address them?
So we have three pieces of IP that makes us what we do. First is the feed tech that I mentioned that was essentially inherited from the Norwegian government. We also have the land-based aquaculture technology that allows us to rear these animals on land in controlled environments and manage our waste. And the third is the actual biological understanding of how these animals behave. And they all behave quite differently around the world. But the key piece, I think, is actually the feed. Because what we do is we use the offcuts of kombu kelp for human consumption. So this is a waste stream from a very environmental source of food, and we're using that as the primary ingredient into our feed. Our feed does not have any fish meal, no fish oil, we have no antibiotics, no hormones, no chemicals, no GMO. It's as natural as it gets, and it's just packed full of umami, and that's why our urchins taste good and are environmentally friendly.
Can you talk a little bit more about the markets you're in and any challenges that you foresee to expand into any other countries, developing countries?
Thank you. Our challenges are not so much about the demand side. The demand is disproportionately larger than the supply we'll ever have. So even with the best Excel models that we built out, we don't even make a dent in the market yet. I think the challenges that we see is that in the East, we can develop more, but in the West, there are regulatory constraints that prevent us from being able to scale up as fast as we'd like to do. And these are some of the reasons why we have selected certain regions where we're operating at this point in time, at least until we can see better clarity in terms of regulations. So some countries are very, they have all the pieces together, but we can't break through the regulatory. Some places are quite convenient, and those were the places where we focus first.
You talked a bit about driving demand on the consumer side for sea urchins. Can you talk about your value proposition to the fishers and how they decide to work with you, how you work with them, how you compensate them?
Yes. Thank you so much. With our type of aquaculture, we're not competing with the wild catch fishers. If any, the wild catch fishers are our best allies. They are the ones that have the permits to go out and collect these urchins on our behalf. So we actually are paying the commercial fishers to harvest these empty urchins for us. Normally, these divers have to go into frigid waters, dive deep into the kelp forest to try to find the best uni and bring them up for processing. We're saying to them now, no, don't go down that deep. Go into the shallows, and all those sea urchins that you normally swim over to get to the good stuff, just collect us those empty ones that are right by your feet, which is a lot easier to do. So we then buy those urchins and ranch them and commercialize them. So if they want to continue with their existing business, absolutely fine. It's just that we're adding another opportunity for them to earn a supplemental income.
It's like undersea arbitrage you're doing there. You're taking the things that were lesser value, pulling them out, driving up.
Correct. And if the blue carbon opportunities develop the way I think it will, what we'll have is not only will we have a revenue opportunity on the sales side, but also through the restoration effort, we kind of get paid on both ends. And that means that we can put more money back into the restoration effort.
Real quick, if you won the money, the $200,000, what would you use it for?
I would double down in California. California. California has the largest species of kelp forest in the world. So the amount of biodiversity we can bring together, if we work on it, is the greatest on the planet. If we prove it in California, we can prove it in the rest of the world.
All right, that was a big finish. Good way to end. Thank you so much, Brian. Love.
He was very clear. He was very clear in his presentation and the way he answered the questions. He seemed to have a very good plan, thought out strategy. That was pretty good.
Hearing your pitch, that's amazing. Okay, let's keep that same energy up for our next ecopreneur, because our next ecopreneur is the co-CEO of Hived and here today from the United Kingdom. Let's welcome Mirva Iqbal. Come on up to the stage.
Hello. So I'm here to talk to you about Hived and how we're building a 10x better parcel delivery for e-commerce or package delivery. We're currently live in UK and expanding rapidly. So I'm sure many of you would have had this problem in your life, especially from Europe and especially from the UK. But I'm sure loads of you share the same sentiment as those screenshots. Parcel delivery is stuck in the dark ages. It's unreliable, it's polluting, outdated, inflexible, and universally disliked by both merchants and recipients. And it's a huge, fast-growing, undisrupted, and very profitable market, but with a massive climate problem. Freight and deliveries account for 25% of London's total carbon emissions from transportation. Globally, transport will be the biggest source of new greenhouse emissions until 2030. And emissions from delivery traffic will increase by 32%, and congestion will rise by over 21%. And as you can see in the graph on the top, on the bottom right corner, the largest 13 parcel sending countries, has a 20% compound annual growth rate of parcel delivery since 2014. And that's expected to double in the next 10 years. And if that's expected to double in the next 10 years, so are the emissions related to it. And as you can see in the top right corner, those two companies are the biggest, two of the biggest parcel delivery companies in the UK. Their profits are skyrocketing. The profit pool alone in the UK is hitting 2 billion. So introducing Hived, a parcel delivery network for the 21st century, 10x better all around, entirely zero emission, price competitive, with seamless integrations.
Zero emissions?
So how do we do it? First principle thinking, we're building a parcel delivery network that's better for the future of our cities, and that means everything. Vertical integration and controlling the whole stack, from the moment that we pick up a parcel from a retailer's warehouse until ding-dong, here's your parcel, we optimize and control the whole flow. We don't have a one-size-fits approach. We don't just have delivery trucks that leave from the depot and go to the city centers. We have cargo bikes, we have normal bikes, we have electric mopeds, we have electric cars and electric vans. And that's needed with the software to enable those to be used at mass market scale. We have decentralized microbes across cities so that there's less mileage and less distance that these bikes actually need to travel, and really optimizing for a mass market scale. And what that results is unmatched service levels, super reliable, and never seen before features. Look at those delivery statistics. They're the best in the industry right now. Full data visibility for the shipper merchant, which is super crucial for merchants. They want more data on their customer, on their deliveries, and how they're interacting. Lots of choices and clear comms and clean UI for end recipients. If you want to change your delivery because you're not home, that's fine. If you want to get in touch, less than 5-minute response time. More options for the modern consumer. And also, we fully employ our drivers and riders as workers and pay them by the hour.
So it seems like it's a mix, and this is basically, she said, in UK, so this is not in the United States, but it seems like a mix between an Amazon and a DoorDash, you know, because they got local hubs to kind of monitor the bike riders, the people who are riding their bikes, and you know, you can ride bikes to deliver for DoorDash and things like that, mopeds and things like that, but what she was saying, as far as the industry is over billions of dollars in the UK, that's a hit. I wonder if she's looking to bring it to the United States or if they're mainly just going to stay in the UK, since that's the research that she's communicated so far. She's only really talked about the growth in the market that's in UK. She haven't really touched on United States. And so I wonder if that's part of the strategy or no, but let's see.
So I've had to redact it because I know this is filming live. But since inception in August 2021, so just over 13 months ago, we've had 35% average month-to-month revenue growth, and we're growing as quick as we can. And yesterday we went live with one of the biggest e-commerce retailers in the UK, ASOS. So why do merchants love using Hived? I've touched on a few of them, but competitive pricing to the incumbents. We're not a premium model here. We're building for a mass market, and we know merchants and retailers, they don't have the margins to pay for premium delivery. But due to our software and our innovation and all the inefficiencies in the large incumbents, we can bring that down on the price. High service levels, more features and options. That results in happy end customers. Merchants save so much time and money on customer inquiries. Because of our software and data and technology, end recipients know exactly when their parcel's arriving. They know exactly to the door when it's expected. And if they do have an inquiry, they can come to us, the carrier, instead of going directly to the merchant, and they'll receive a less than 5-minute response time. Increase customer retention when using Hive, and we can prove that with some case studies. And of course, saving thousands of tons of CO2 emissions. Just some more example about merchants, recipients loving Hive. 5-star Trustpilot reviews by the Glow. And this is not over a few hundred deliveries. In the past sort of 13 months, we've successfully delivered hundreds of thousands of deliveries so far.
Should say 13 months?
But we wouldn't be here without our amazing team. And shout out to all of you in London, because I know I'm sure you're watching. But we've got an amazing superstar team from the likes of Amazon, Gusto, Revolut, Bain & Co., ex-Oxbridge grads. So thank you for listening.
Excellent. Excellent, Mirva. That's so exciting. Okay, here we go again. We're going to start the clock. You'll have 10 minutes.
Sure.
And I got your back. I'm right over here.
Cool.
Thank you, Mirva. You know, it's, I think, in the climate transition, trying to balance consumer demands and our consumption desires with decarbonization objectives is always a challenge, so I really appreciate you enabling shopping, but doing it in a more conscious way. Can you talk a little bit about what profiles of markets are best for you in terms of geography? You know, do we need a local high street with a lot of shops and a lot of kind of time is now deliveries? Or just talk a little bit about how you think about expansion over
there. For the geography. So right now we're based in the Greater London area, but for us, we have ambition to be the largest parcel delivery company in Europe. So we're not just looking at high street in dense areas. We're currently nationwide collection. So for ASOS, for instance, we're collecting nationwide. So we don't just collect from shops, we collect from the depots of these big merchants across the country. And we are pioneering in that with electric vehicle technology, but we know we're on the forefront. We know the merchants want this. So it's not just a localized, a small segment of the delivery sector we're taking. We're really going after mass market, because for this to actually make an impact and transform this industry, you really need to think mass scale and how we can make this mass scale.
So no plans for the Bay Area anytime soon?
So the UK first, definitely Europe. There's some key markets we're already looking. There are a few areas in the US that we've looked at, but like I said, we're only 13 months in, so things might change.
See, that's a bummer, because I live in the Bay Area, and I think all of us sustainability professionals definitely have our vices, and I think shopping and being able to receive things is certainly one of mine. I'm curious how you think about your climate impact or your emissions impact, and particularly how that's going to change over time as competitors raise the bar on their own sustainability practices.
So for us, climate is table stakes. So it's not just our USP, but if we're building a mass market parcel delivery network for the 21st century, by default, it has to be zero emission. So zero emission is just like, that's one of the features, but that's not our competitive advantage, let's say. It's more about the customer service, the experience of actually receiving a parcel delivery. And to your question and on the emissions part, so right now we're zero tailpipe emissions. We are looking at things like the tires, because we know there's a lot of air pollution related to the tires and things like that. And our team are looking every day at what can we do to be bigger. We're partnering with some of the amazing companies across the globe to figure out what we can do even better on the manufacturing side and things like that. Hope that answers. We're not just, green delivery is not our USP.
Have you been out marketing your solution, and what makes it unique?
Our marketing solution. Did you see our cool vehicles?
Yeah.
So they're a marketing solution in themselves. So we take branding is really important to everyone at Hived and what we do. And our delivery vehicles and our bikes and cargo bikes, they're on the roads every single day. And they don't look like the boring UPS or FedEx trucks. Sorry if anyone's here from FedEx or UPS. But they're really funky and fun. And not just that. The merchants and the brands that actually use Hive for their delivery, they love shouting out about working with us. So they're doing collaborations and marketing PR. Hey, we're so excited to announce that we're now delivering with Hive. We also own the whole checkout experience. So once a delivery has been placed, we own that email communication. So, hey, your parcel, we've collected your parcel from ASOS. Hive will be delivering it in the next day or something like that. So it's everywhere, our name.
Let me follow up with this. I own a lot of businesses. Some of them are high margin, some of them are low margin.
Yep.
Which one is yours?
We're definitely on the scale on the Amazon side, but every innovation and efficiency is 1-10% here can really make a huge difference if you bring this at scale. So yes, we're not on the super high margin, but that's in the vision potentially.
Mirva, can you talk a little bit about the technology differentiation in your business model and what prevents others like Amazon or Uber from displacing you?
Yeah, cool. So we are not a direct competitor to Amazon, because Amazon have their own sort of delivery for their merchants. We deliver for the companies, not Amazon. The technology is getting better every single day. We're mainly a data-first company. We kind of call ourselves a data company first. We collect so much data day in, day out, all those data points, and it's about how we can utilize that data better every day to make better decisions. We don't just look at the way, okay, this is how parcels are normally sorted, let's do it that way. We're looking at every single part of the chain. Okay, the data is telling us how can we improve, how can we change routing optimization, for instance. We're getting better in our routing engine and making more optimizations on routing. So I can't say there's one silver bullet, a magic bullet for the technology. It's just everywhere, and we focus on the most efficiency things at the first.
How are you thinking about scaling beyond last mile delivery?
Yeah, so we actually do the whole middle mile, so we actually collect. So I'll give you an example. So if you're just ordering on ASOS, I can't figure the equivalent in the US, but ASOS, you check out. Everything from that point onwards, Hive deals with. So we'll go to Nationwide, wherever their depot is, to collect that parcel in bulk. We'll take it to our depot, and then what we do is that we'll sort it different. It might go off to mini micro hubs. It might just go straight from that depot and go out from delivery from that perspective. So it's kind of the whole chain. And we believe the value add is having that deep integration with the merchants and retailers directly.
Ah, and so I understand, because Amazon is known for the last mile delivery, picking it up and getting it to your doorstep after you do that. She's saying right after you hit purchase or whatever, the emails come to them, all of the communication flows and comes through them as to where to go pick up that product and where it's going, and all the information in between that. And so I think I understand what she was saying as far as not being just a last mile delivery service, but she's that whole part from, you know, after the order. So that's how she makes a difference between her and the Amazons.
Can you talk a little bit about your unit economics, whatever you can share, and just how you think about being able to drive those and improve them over time?
For sure. I'll be careful about what I can share, because I know it's a stream live, but I'll just give you an example. And this might sound crazy, but we only raised $2.4 million initially when we started. And in the venture world for initial funding, that's not a crazy amount. But we've been super capital efficient. We have raised money a couple of weeks ago more. We've been super capital efficient to get where we are, and we've delivered over hundreds of thousands of deliveries. So I figure you can maybe do the math of where we're going with this. We purposely were frugal at the start, because we believe if you have too much money at the start, you might not have the pure focus and attention on unit economics, as we always have done. It's baked into our culture, our mindset, and everything we do. I think I can give you more later.
One more question from me. How do you think about maintaining a high level of customer service as you scale, and how does that influence what parts of the business you keep in-house versus what parts you contract out, if that becomes a part of your strategy?
For sure. At the moment, it's all in-house, and we think it will be for the foreseeable future. It's all about getting better with the data and the questions that, you know, we're facing on the customer service side. A lot of them is all about technology. If we can make our actual, you know, outbound communication more efficient and more granular to the end recipient, you know, if things, let's be honest, things will go wrong, right? We're delivering thousands and thousands and thousands of parcels a day. There's going to be something that happens. But if we can measure that proactively, and we already know that's coming, and notify that customer, hey, look, there's been a bump on the road. Your parcel is actually going to be delivered 20 minutes later than we initially stated. Those things drive down the customer service a lot. People just want to be heard. I think everyone here can, you know, share that same sentiment of calling a customer service agent and no one responding 30, 40 minutes. We want to be that company and our software and technology to kind of preempt and react to that first. And if they do come to us, always respond. That's our kind of motto. And as that scale, it might change.
What's the biggest opportunity? Is that here in North America, or is that abroad?
So the UK is one of the highest penetrated e-commerce industries across the world. So UK is an amazing opportunity for us, and that's why we started there. And so and the rest of Europe. So that's a huge opportunity for us right now. That's where we're based.
And then talk to me about if you win.
Yep.
You win this $200,000. What would you do with it?
I think more support in the tech team. I think our tech lead will be happy to hear that. a few more software engineers, and also reinvestments of the team. I can't underestimate how much of an amazing job the team do in day out. So if there's anything that we can do as a company to support them with more initiatives, more courses, more learnings, it'll probably go into that.
And are you owning those vehicles, or are you leasing those vehicles?
We lease them. We lease them, finance them, yeah.
Have you noticed any competitive reaction from any of the incumbent players in the market you're in?
So the incumbent players have a lot of good greenwashing PR, but when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, how do you transform a huge old company that they've been using, right, and transform all their vehicles electric? They don't have the infrastructure to actually use cargo bikes at scale. They might use a few cargo bikes here and there for a bit of press opportunities, but are they really using them mass market scale? They'll have to really reinvent their whole wheel, which they're not doing.
Talk to me about the exit strategy? What's your exit strategy? All of us want to know, right? Yeah.
So for me, I love this. This is the biggest passion I've ever had. It makes me the happiest. I want to see the vision out to Hyde. We're building a parcel delivery company right now, but we're digitally touching and physically touching everyone's homes in the UK and then hopefully Europe. What more can we do with that? What more can we leverage? There's huge other opportunities that we can then go into. So there's a strong vision for that. That's where we're going, and just continue. This IPO, that's where I want to go.
Wonderful.
Awesome. How about a big round of applause?
Thank you.
For Mirva Iqbal. Thank you.
She did good with her presentation. I like the way they are very just kind of off the cuff, know their business, know their numbers, know their plan, their strategy. I love how they are presenting, you know, to the judges. But she did say something that kind of got me to thinking. One is he asked her, what would she do with the money? She said she would hire more software engineers and probably do more for the team. But then he followed it up with, do you own the vehicles? She said, no, they're leasing the vehicles. And then she compared that to the other competitors that probably only do green, you know, electric vehicle delivery for press opportunities. But if that whole structure of hers fall, then she won't have, if she can no longer lease the vehicles, or if she runs into a battle of maintaining these electrical vehicles, then she also has a problem because that's the foundation of her business. And so I would love to understand a little bit more about why she wouldn't use the money to purchase more vehicles or to own, you know, and down and just buy out the vehicles instead of continuing to lease them. I would wonder why that's not an option for her, but maybe 200K is not enough. I don't know, but I would definitely want to own at least a good fleet of electrical vehicles if that's the premise of my whole business. Although she was speaking to customer service and all of the data that she's able to collect as being one of her big things that she do for the business. So very good, interesting, you know, pitch for Hyve. And so let's keep going.
Great questions from our judges, an amazing presentation so far, and we have one more to go. So next up and our final ecopreneur is the co-founder and head of partnerships at Veritree. Here today from Canada, please welcome David Luba to the stage.
Hey, thanks for having me. My name's David. I'm one of the co-founders of Veritree. We make it easy for businesses to help restore the planet. Now, before I go into that, I want to tell you about my t-shirt. This is a Tentree shirt. Tentree is a brand my friends and I started in college 10 years ago. And the idea is simple. For every item purchased, 10 trees are planted, giving the end consumer the opportunity to help us restore the planet. This restorative business model has given us a unique competitive advantage, especially with the growth of the conscious consumer. By the end of this year, we will have planted over 100 million trees all around the world. That's a forest so vast, it would be 18.5 million basketball courts, a forest. If a few college kids like us can do this, it's proof any business has the power to be restorative. I traveled to our sites and I saw the impact firsthand, and it was incredible. Not only were our trees sequestering carbon, but they were restoring biodiversity. They were providing food. They were lifting people out of poverty by providing jobs, and this is life-changing. However, after investing millions in restorative actions and traveling to our sites, we still couldn't answer simple questions. I was at one of our projects, and I wanted to see our trees firsthand. What impact did our trees have? But we weren't able to separate our trees from the rest. It got us thinking, how do we know if the trees we invested in are real? How do we know if they survived? How do we know if they weren't double counted? And most importantly, we were asking ourselves, all this work we put in to grow in this t-shirt company, How do we know we're creating a positive impact? We created Veritree to answer these questions, and soon we realized this technology has the power to help every business in the world become restorative. This is how it works. We partner with a planting partner on the ground to set up and collaborate on the project. We set a baseline, we set goals for what we want to accomplish, and we understand the risks of degradation. After that project is set up, we get to work, and we collect data from the ground while the work is being done. This data is GPS coordinates, who's planting, what type of species, where, when, how, who, all this great data, as well as other socioeconomic forms of data as well. This data is then captured, reviewed, and verified by our team, and we tokenize it using blockchain to eliminate the risk of double counting. This data is then published on Arweave blockchain for the world to see, because this is immutable planetary data future generations can use to restore our planet. The data is then taken and consolidated for our corporate partners into an easy to read, easy to visualize dashboard, showcasing their impact so they can measure, monitor, and celebrate it with their communities. Here's how some of our partners are using Veritree. We've got hotels planting trees for guests who opt out of cleaning service, saving the hotels money, water, and energy. We've got 1 out of every 10 e-commerce customers investing in verified restoration at checkout, helping us restore the world. And we've seen a 21% increase in lifetime value when a 10-tree customer scans a QR code and interacts directly with their impact. The UN State of Finance has identified we need $8.1 trillion invested in nature to meet our climate targets. And they're forecasting we come up short by $4 trillion. These are some of the partners that are helping us close that gap. At 10Tree, it took us 6 years to plant 15 million trees. And at Veritree, we will have done that by the end of this year. I took this photo when I was in Madagascar playing soccer with the locals, and I couldn't figure out why everyone wanted a photo with me so bad, until it hit me. They've never seen a picture of themselves before. So when I thought about that, I was like, wow, we are using technology to inspire consumers, to inspire businesses, to inspire planting partners on the ground, and to inspire locals to restore the planet. Now, we can't close this gap ourselves, this $4.1 trillion gap. But if 10Tree has taught us anything, it is big change starts small, and we can do this.
I like the fact that he incorporates the blockchain, you know, for verification, because those are some good questions that you would have. If I purchase a t-shirt, how do I know that my tree is actually being planted? You know, and so to ascribe a number on the blockchain for each of the trees that are being planted, that's a way to kind of identify, verify, and make sure there's no duplicated numbers being counted. So good use of the technology with the data that he's going to be, you know, collecting and showing to these product or to the merchants, the people who purchase these products or t-shirts, I believe.
Congratulations. Good job.
I love so much that 10Tree is powered by Veritree and then has created a mechanism to allow consumers and NGOs and other businesses to track the impact through the wallet. So it's amazing. You talked a little bit about your vision to establish 10Tree or Veritree as a trusted entity. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your plan to establish brand recognition in the market.
I think it really comes down to the standard. There's a lot of noise out there right now in the carbon market, and the carbon market is great. We need more nature and investment. But for us to establish a standard that is holistic, where we're not just carbon focused, but we're also really focused on some of these other benefits and empowering the locals, right? Like poverty alleviation, helping locals like avoid degradation, but also making sure we're able to go there, verify that, and then our partners do a lot of the work for us. We've got some amazing partners up on the board. People want to invest in nature, but they just want it to be compelling, they want it to be measurable, they want it to be transparent. So we've had a lot of our partners help us restore the planet. And we get a lot of leads from Tentree. A lot of people look at Tentree and what we've been able to create, and they say, I want my business to be like that, or I want to invest in measurable restoration. So that's really helped us get the brand out there in the market. So Tentree is a great example of what we're trying to accomplish.
So is the heart of your marketing strategy through these NGOs and partners and then the consumers at Tentree?
It's a little bit of both. We've got some great, it's absolutely through referrals and through people really wanting to invest in the planet. Like, we are filling the supply gap. So many people want to invest in the planet, but they don't know how. You can go and make a donation to an NGO, which is awesome. You can go and buy a carbon credit, which is awesome as well. But there needs to be more products, there needs to be more transparency, there needs to be more ways people can invest, and it really needs to be holistic, looking at all the different benefits from this. So we're really trying to fulfill that supply, inspire companies to become restorative, and show them the business benefits. Like when we looked at the hotels and the customer lifetime value, those are just some of many. I've been so impressed with how creative businesses have been to bring restoration to their model. It's been pretty cool.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about how you get your tools, your technology, into the hands of these project partners around the world in some of these developing market jurisdictions? How do you train them? How do you support them in using the tools, ensure they're used correctly so you can provide the transparency you seek to?
Yeah, we get in the mud ourselves. We flew to Madagascar right before the pandemic. I brought about 50 cell phones in my bag, and security's like, what are you doing with all these cell phones? And we deployed the cell phones. Our first version of the app was all icon-based, so we could get around from the language barriers. And we trained the locals on how to use the technology. Now, it's not an easy process, and we're continuing to evolve, and we're continuing to essentially update the app and make it also a tool for our planting partners. They're using it to help people so they know where to plant. If someone's planting in the wrong area, their phone will vibrate and say, come over here, this is where you're going to be restoring. So we can then map out exactly where we're restoring, and then we can go back there and take like soil samples later. We can look at how we're like changing the biodiversity. We can use best practices. So we're not here just to verify and measure, we're here to help everyone with best practices. Imagine the data we can collect from all these different groups and the scale, and if we can share that with everyone in the industry, we've got to stop working in silos so we can restore our planet.
Super inspiring that you've been working on this for such a long time, before Veritree with Tentrees and the t-shirts. I'm curious, as you're working with these communities on the ground, how you make sure that you're compensating them fairly, how you think about equity and justice as you're working with what I imagine in large part are indigenous communities, many of whom have been in these areas for long times, and how you maintain that level of the integrity of that relationship as the company grows.
Yeah, it's a great question. We've developed the Veritree standard. So there's 10 impacts we look at. One of those impacts is income. Another impact is culture, for instance. How is this positively or negatively impacting culture? Because we want to make sure we're having a positive impact. So we've got 10 different impacts we measure, climate, carbon being one of those impacts, biodiversity being another one. So we're always using data and doing surveys with the locals and making sure this is positively impacting them, which helps create a more equitable world as well. Because if we can take funds from one area and invest it in another, it helps solve a lot of problems. And we've got to give power to the people. Without people, we can't restore our planet. If we're just focused on the inputs, we've got to focus on the outputs and what goes into creating those outputs.
Well, what comes first, revenues or social impact?
Social impact. Like at the end of the day, like everything's a balancing act. Even with Tentree, we were looking at new products and we're like, okay, this product, it was always a dilemma. We could do X amount more with this impact or with this new product, but maybe this product's not good for the environment. But we'd always center ourselves and be like, if it makes good business sense and that can allow us to reinvest and scale, which will help the greater cause of the planet. So we're always weighing that. But at the end of the day, like you need profits to grow your impact. But we're not going to sacrifice impact at the expense of profit. So we're trying to always find that right balance, if that makes sense.
So what are the short-term and long-term sustainability impacts? And how can you prove it?
Absolutely. Well, we're here to prove it. That's why we created Veritree. But short-term is getting businesses to be restorative. And this isn't a one-and-done type of thing. We've got other companies planting trees for every product they sell. So short-term is getting people to be restorative and looking at the immediate impact, what trees are getting planted and when, and the people. Like, that's pretty immediate. If you go out and you're doing work, you can manage that. Long-term is really looking at the health of the forest and understanding, like, what we're doing in that area, because everyone's rushing to plant trees right now, but are we doing it the right way? So longer-term, monitoring that biodiversity, making sure we're planting the right species in the right place so we can effectively move things forward. And how we verify that is through our platform. So our partners get a customer-facing dashboard, like the one I was showing you, but they also get a partner portal in the back. And the partner portal has all of the form submissions saying, this is what day we restored this area, here's the photo from the area, here's when it was verified by the Veritree team, tokenized using blockchain, and you can go there and see for yourselves. And then we've got different like levels of standards, where if it's Veritree Gold, you'll get more updates. So we exist to make this and create new digital assets, like biodiversity credits in the future. There's so much opportunity. We're really excited about what technology can do for us.
And if you won this money.
Pardon?
If you won this $200,000, first thing you're going to do with it?
I think we would bring on more scientists and people that can advise us on how we can create the biggest positive impact. We're just a couple of college guys that started a clothing company, and then somehow now we've got this tech business that's helping restore the planet. So it would be bringing on the right experts, as well as helping develop our software to make sure we're doing everything we can and make that software dynamic too, so we can integrate with other businesses and we can kind of be the tunnels and not the city to help everyone.
Magic, I was going to steal your question this time.
Well, I had to ask them, see. I asked the other two. I had to ask them, too.
I know. David, can you walk us a little bit through your scalability assumptions?
Yeah, I think we can scale pretty quickly. Like, you think about our global impact. We're working with an airline in Germany, Hanair, to restore the planet. We're working with a business in Korea, Samsung. And we're working with businesses here at home. But what's really cool is because we are a platform that can consolidate projects with different NGOs and different groups, we can scale pretty quickly. We also don't have the red tape right now that like a carbon credit project has, so we can move pretty quickly. I was actually talking to Brian, and one of our seaforestation projects in Canada is actually in partnership with his Sea Urchin. So how cool is that? We had no idea that was happening. So it allows us to also grow quickly and scale outside of just restoration. So we're doing like agroforestry. We're providing food for people, and how we measure that is we look at the yield. It might not be as much of a carbon project, but we look at the yield. We're also looking at things like rebuilding a coral reef in Florida. So as we can scale up demand, and hopefully we can scale up more supply, we can help contribute to that $4.1 trillion gap we need to close by 2050.
I was curious to hear more about the impact sort of hub you described, or sort of the portal where people can see their consumer individual impact and then the corporate can, and just what kind of engagement you see with that. As an investor in climate, I always wonder sort of what people's motivations are when they partner with you. Are they really digging into the numbers? Are they really digging into their impact and working with you to understand it better?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're seeing a high level of engagement. It's one of the most visited pages for a lot of our partners. And these QR codes are typically, which link the end consumer to their impact. They're on, like for instance, we've got a gummy company where you can scan the QR code and go to your impact. But what makes it so unique is how we can pop up projects at different times of the year. So whether it's maybe around July 4th and someone wants to restore a forest fire in their own backyard, boom, they can be like, check out our new project. So we're always updating it. Or maybe there's World Ocean Day and we want to invest in kelp. So we're able to make it very dynamic. We've got one of the largest retailers in Canada working with us right now. And we set up for them a coast-to-coast forest. So we've got a tree planting site in every single province, which is pretty cool. So I think the fact we can be dynamic keeps bringing people back. And now businesses, and as we evolve it, we're like incentivizing more people to basically kind of join this movement. So it's pretty exciting.
To use Magic's analogy, how does Veritree stay a step ahead of the Michael Jordans and the Larry Birds of your industry?
I really think it's breaking down those silos, and we've got this island right now, and this island is essentially our technology on the ground. We're in the trenches, in mud up to our knees, and crabs are crawling around in Madagascar. We're in there in the field figuring out what we need to do to empower restoration. but we're also building our system in a way that we can easily integrate with the latest technology. We can easily integrate with something new that comes out. So we're not building the whole city, but we're building what we've developed over the last 10 years, or like what we've understood about tree planting. But what gives us a unique advantage is we have the consumer like focus from Tentree that a lot of businesses in our space don't have. And it allows us to get more money into restorative actions from marketing departments because we can show customer lifetime value. So for us, it's not about coming to like cannibalize people in the space. It's how do we bring in more like money into the restoration space? So that's how we hopefully can stay ahead.
Great. All right. How about a round of applause, David?
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much, David.
I like this presentation overall, and I get it now. They started as a t-shirt company, and now they're going into tech. So from t-shirts to tech. And they have this technology where they can understand the data. They can read all the data and make, you know, updates based on, you know, the climate control and the goals that they have for that. So I understand that. I think he was very kind of, not very, but I think he was evasive to numbers. I think there was a couple of questions where the judges asked them what, you know, like I know Mia asked, how do you keep the integrity with the countries that you're going into and the cities and the local hubs that you're going into, employing the people? How can you keep integrity with that? I don't think I was satisfied with the answer that he gave. And that's to say, I don't even know if he answered the question, and maybe I missed it, but he seemed to give a lot of theory and a lot of, you know, research on that and not really any hardcore numbers. There was another question, it escapes my mind right now, but there was another question where he was asked a value type of question and he did not directly answer that. And so I don't know if he just didn't know the numbers or he was just some kind of evasive in those areas with actually sharing all of the data that he supposedly has for this company. And so that was the last pitch. Let's see who's going to win. I like the Sea Urchin. I think that was the more interesting, you know, type of climate control, ecopreneur type of business that I've heard so far. Remember, they are being judged based on the creativity of their business, the scalability of their business, and then the sustainability of their business. And I really believe the business with the unis and the seafood is a kind of a step ahead of the others. And I also like them because they have the United States as a part of their strategy. So he shared that, you know, they've been doing some research in California, and that's where he will double down. And so he's bringing jobs and opportunities. And then he has a good model where he's going to not compete with the fishermen's, but he's going to actually try to give them an extra stream of income. And so I like his business model. I like the futuristic type of goal that he really has, and he definitely communicated his goals. He answered the questions very clearly to the point where even I understood them, and I don't know anything about the climate of the sea and all of that good stuff. So I really hope that he wins, but let's see.
Thank you. We see that I have the magic envelope in my hands. But I'll tell you what, when I went down to my seat, when everybody was pitching, I thought to myself, I'm going to call Deloitte. I'm calling the co-CEOs. I'm calling Amy, our CFO, because I was so inspired by the three of you. I wanted everybody to be a winner. So our runner-up ecopreneurs are each going to receive $100,000.
So everybody can win. You're getting ready. You win. Okay, and so the winner is going to get $200,000 for their business, and then the other two people will each also get $1,000, $100,000 each. And so that's real good. That was very nice.
But there can only be one champion of DreamFest 2022. And our winner for this year is none other than Brian Tsuyoshi Takeda. So let's thank our ecopreneurs. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it, Merva, Brian, and David. And you can come down the stairs here, and Dunya, Saloni, Mia, and of course, Magic Johnson. A big round of applause for our judges.
Okay, so that was real nice and different. I know that Salesforce has a show on their channel, on Salesforce Plus, that they talk about other ecopreneurs and what they're doing for the climate using data and the technology and stuff that they use. And so I'll link to that below. Make sure you check that channel out and watch some of their shows. But this was pretty cool and a good cause. And I love all the tech talk that was behind it, how they're using the data and all of that good stuff, and what we're going to see to come in the years where technology is just going to be so useful for any business. And so kudos to Brian for winning the 200K. I really think his mission, and definitely with the goal of coming into the States and employing and giving income to some of the fishers, I think that was mainly probably why he won. I hope that's why he won. But congratulations to him. And thank you guys so much for tuning in and staying until the end. I really do appreciate it. Make sure you hit that like button and become a subscriber to the channel if you like this content. And make sure you check us out for the next ones.